Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another edition of the F Y'all Podcast. I am your co-host, Michael Wright. And across from me, as always, is the man you came to see, the one, the only, the legendary Superman from Compton, Mr. C.T. Fletcher. Pops, how you feeling today, sir?
I am blessed as always and very excited for our guest today.
Yes, we got a very special guest. Today, we have the incredible Stephanie Arnold, Emmy-nominated producer, author of 37 Seconds, Dying Revealed Heaven's Help. Stephanie's life took a dramatic turn during childbirth when she flatlined for 37 seconds and had a profound spiritual experience. Join us as we explore her journey of premonition, survival, and the power of intuition. This is a story of courage, resilience that you don't want to miss. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the C.T. Fletcher Presents the F Y'all Podcast, Miss Stephanie Arnold. How are you today?
Just like C.T. says, I'm blessed. Any day if I'm grounded is a good day.
Absolutely.
Most definitely. So we have a lot to talk about. C.T., very rarely does C.T. tell me, son, I need this person on the show. And you have been one of those people. We have had a lot of big name guests on this show, but you were one of the ones he said, I'm going to send you this lady's information. I want you to look her up, reach out to her. I got to have her on the show. And that says a lot, because very rarely does he tell me anybody that he wants to be on this show. We pull people, but you have been one of the top people he has wanted. So, Pops, actually, I'm going to let you start it off. I know you had a lot that you wanted to ask about, so I want to let you start this show off.
We, Stephanie, we are in a very rare club, and that's people that have experienced the other side. We both have flatlined. I did it on five different occasions, but you've experienced it, so it's not often I get to talk to somebody who's had that experience. So that's why I couldn't wait to have you on the show. I told Mike, you know, I don't get to talk to many other dead people. So I definitely want to have, because I have questions, and I want to know if how similar our experiences were. In fact, when we first started about thought about doing a podcast, I almost wanted to do the podcast entirely talking to people like us, people that experienced, you know, dying. And live to tell the story. I thought that would have been a fantastic podcast. They have nothing but people like us on there, but it didn't turn out like that. So my first question is, you had a premonition.
I did.
A premonition to me is like your spidey senses are kicking in that something ominous is going to happen. Something not good is going to happen. And I've had those myself, so I know. I was telling Mike, I used to work for the post office and I was a forklift driver, and I had a premonition I was going to hit my head. And you know, for like 6 weeks before I actually hit my head, I was ducking. Every time I would come close to a doorway, anything, I was ducking because I had this overwhelming feeling that something bad was when I was going to hit my head. And as soon as I relaxed, Stephanie, bam. That's what it happened. So you left 10 stitches right across the forehead. So I want to know, how was you're trying to tell everybody something's bad going to happen. Nobody believed you, because a lot of people don't even believe in premonition. But how was the premonition for you?
I mean, I talk about it, and you know, in the military, it's like that spidey sense, or I call it a knowing. You don't know how you know. And whether you believe that intuition comes from a spiritual place, which I do, or we're hardwired, I'm just saying, listen to it, because I can tell you with wives and children and everything else, it's like, I'm sure they have said things where you're like, nah, we'll blow it off, forget it, whatever. And then it comes true. And they're like, I told you.
So
I was pregnant with our second child, and I had our first child, no problem, no issue other than the fact that she was too big. So I had a C-section. So this wasn't the fear of the unknown. I was pregnant with our son, and at the 20-week ultrasound, and let me know if I'm going into too much female stuff. I told Michael, I was like, you're going to learn a lot about vaginas.
No, please go ahead.
So I was diagnosed with a placenta previa, which is a 1 in 200 risk where the placenta sits on top of the uterus, or it sits on top of the cervix. If it doesn't move throughout the pregnancy, then the worst thing that happens is you have a C-section. But in that moment, I knew there was something wrong, and I knew that it was going to be bad. And I told my husband, I said, you know, I have a really rare blood type as O negative. I said, I don't want to be special in any category. And he's like, honey, you're at NYU and you're also at Northwestern Memorial in Chicago. We were splitting the time between the two. He's like, you have great prenatal care. What are you stressed about? I'm like, I don't know. And it just was this knowing. So when I went home, what do? You Google what a placenta previa is. And then it turns out that what it could happen would be a placenta accreta, which is what Kim Kardashian had when the placenta and the uterus marry itself to each other. Yeah. If that happens, you can bleed. If that happens, you might need a hysterectomy and you might hemorrhage, and in which case you and the baby might lose your life. And in that moment, it was as clear as day that that was going to happen to me. The only difference was the baby was going to survive, but I was sure that it was going to happen. And it was like you said, it was ominous. So I was 20-week ultrasound up until I delivered. It was like 3 months. So what I did was I told everybody, I told all doctors, nurses, I said, my placenta previa is going to turn into an accreta. I'm going to hemorrhage. You guys are going to need a lot of blood. I'm going to be cut from sternum and pelvis. You're going to need a hysterectomy. I'm going to die on the operating table. Baby's going to be fine. And I went like this to everybody. And every single clinician was like, this bitch is crazy. She needs medication. She needs sleep medication, whatever, you know, you're pregnant, you're hormonal. And you know, my husband, who is a PhD from University of Chicago, he's a former Air Force pilot. He likes data. And so this does not equate as data. Me having a feeling, as much as he loves me and he wants to help me, he's like, this does not make sense. So he went with me on every appointment. I would say the same thing. They would calm my nerves or try to by saying this, you know, what you're afraid of happening is never going to happen. And then at some point, I learned that if I needed a hysterectomy during the delivery, my OB could not do it. And I had to have a gynecological oncologist do it. So if you're not diagnosed with something like an accreta, there's no reason to go see a gynonc. Yet I made an appointment with the gynonc and the doctor's like, how can we help you? And my husband was there and he was embarrassed to be there because there are women who are suffering from cancer. They are struggling. And I am a healthy 7-month pregnant woman sitting there and saying, this is going to happen. And the doctor's like, Mrs. Arnold, have you been on the internet? And I was like, why, yes, I have, doctor. This is going to happen. And so turns out like the resident stopped writing the notes. I am wasting this person's time. They prescribe an MRI. Maybe the MRI will indicate there's something wrong. You know, I wasn't confident that any one person could tell me what was happening, but I felt it coming and I saw it like, you know, everybody saw this open road and I saw this 18-wheeler headed straight for me and nobody else could see it. And so I was hoping by talking to a doctor who specializes in cancer, another doctor who specializes in blood, another doc, you know, Facebook, when I posted on Facebook, I was like, maybe somebody has heard this kind of foreboding and maybe they can tell me what happened. I mean, I was going to ask you prior to your heart attack, did you have any sense of foreboding?
But I knew I was sick. I knew I was sick, but I did not know I was going to have a heart attack. But I absolutely, this is quote similar to what you're saying. Before I had the heart transplant, I did a lot of studying, a lot of reading, internet, and I read the percentages of man to woman heart transplants and how the life expectancy of the man, if he received a woman's heart, was a lot less than if he got a man's heart, man to man. And I just had a feeling, you know, and they were not supposed to tell me anything about my donor. They weren't supposed to tell me anything about my donor. And a doctor, he would come in every day, Stephanie, would ask me, how are you, Mr. Fletcher? And I always say, I'm blessed. And I could tell that he didn't really like that response, you know, for something, you know, I think, you know, he wanted me to give more credit to him, you know, and I gave a lot of credit to God. I always do and I always will. And he was like, well, let me tell you something, Mr. Fletcher. You got a transplant, but you got it from a woman and she's about your age. She's only a couple years younger than you. So you think you're doing great and you're giving all this praise to God, but you ain't doing so hot, buddy. Yeah. Wow. And that really, you know, so I was really thrown back by that. And you know, so your premonition that something was going to go wrong during this. And I had a little feeling that, hey, I kept, you know, these ladies' heart to men is not good. It's not good. And I wasn't supposed to know. But he made it his business to tell me that you got a lady's heart and she's not that much younger than you. So I'm like, oh, man.
That's an asshole thing to say. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, your motivation and your faith and your belief in what you yourself can do with whatever little you're given or whatever great you're given, that's in your hands, not a, you know, an egotistical, you know, clinician wants to just knock you down. You know, I just think that's bullshit.
All right, anyway. Well, Stephanie, can I ask you real quick, as you're trying to explain this to your doctors, what level of frustration are you at knowing that they did not believe what you were trying to explain to them?
I was petrified because I'm coming across just like you would when you do your research. I mean, I was a TV producer before, so I do a lot of research prior to doing anything. And so I had a very finite amount of time to save my life. So I was racing against a clock that I knew. I didn't know when exactly I was going to. I only knew that was when I gave birth. And so that birth date could happen anytime. And the frustration was real. It was, I would tell them these things. They'd be like, oh, I'm sorry that you're still having those visions. Is there anything, you know, we're in a teaching hospital. We are, we prepare for emergencies, but it was like missing, like they weren't actually, there was only one doctor, who actually heard the story, my anesthesiologist, a future anesthesiologist phone call that I had, but all the doctors were like, no, you're fine. Everything's fine. You're within range. The amniotic fluid is fine. Baby is fine. You're just stressed. You know, maybe because you're having your first boy, it's too much testosterone running through your system, whatever, you know? And so I think when I lecture now at hospitals, I say, you know, my doctors were missing one thing. It was like, they were missing that I'd had a baby before with them. This was not typical behavior of me. You know, I function at a very high pressured career and I've had a baby before. I'd had a C-section before. So there were things that they were missing instead of trying to say, maybe there's something else we can hear, listen to, whatever. So it was really frustrating and very scary. And then having the love of my life by my side saying, honey, everything's fine, you know, and him trying to use the best tools he has in his toolbox. And, you know, if you see the Netflix show that we're on, that Surviving Death in episode one, he got a ton of hate mail. They were like, you know, he's an asshole. You shouldn't stay married to him. he's not spiritual and everything. And it's not that way at all. He's just, he likes everything to fit in this puzzle. Mm-hmm. And he's like, there's always outliers. He's like, I just didn't think you'd be one of them, you know? And so no one thinks you're going to be one of them, but it's got to happen to somebody.
Yep.
You know, so.
And why not you?
I mean, and that's the thing, you know, people have asked, you know, well, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I'm like, when you hear the story and how much went into it, you know, do you really think that I can cause my organs to combine, or can you actually have a real premonition of, you know, you're going to hit your head and you don't know when it's going to happen, but you feel it coming. Absolutely. That's not manifesting it.
No, you just know it's gonna happen. It's something else, man. If nobody ever experienced it, it's very difficult to explain.
It's horrible. Yeah.
So can you walk me through this particular day? How did that day start? And what was it like up until
I gave
all
birth?
The tragedy? Yes.
Yeah. So it was, my husband, of course, had to fly to New York. I was grounded in Chicago. And so I was scheduled C-section at 37 weeks, but at 36 weeks to the day, he, like a typical husband, was like, I got another week. So he goes to his meeting.
I think we all men are like ready to go to the same school or something. We just
I was like, oh, fine. But you know what? God works in mysterious ways, because when you find out what happens, you know, it's for him, he had a lot to deal with, but at least he didn't see it happen. And he feels very guilty for not being there. But I said, God works in mysterious ways. It's one thing to hear that your wife flatlined. It's another thing to see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Yeah.
And
didn't even think of it from that perspective as I was researching it and trying to see it from his point of view, but never thought about it like that.
Yeah. I mean, his part, he's like, I wasn't there to protect you. I wasn't there to be there, at least just stand next. So what started out as a normal breakfast in the morning, I was feeding my daughter, who was two at the time, or a little under two, and our nanny was there, and I started bleeding all over the kitchen floor. So I knew that today's the day. Mm-hmm. And so my nanny goes into the car and goes into the driver's seat. And I said, I'm driving. And she is like, Stephanie, you're bleeding. I said, yeah. I've had lots of premonitions. Dying in a car accident was not one of them. Get the fuck in the back. Because I'm like, I know what I need to do. And I know how to get there, and you'll drive too slow. So I get to the hospital and get triaged and what have you. And my husband knows now that we're having an emergency C-section. So he's getting on a plane and he's like, I think I'll make it. Door to door from New York to Chicago hospital to Midtown Manhattan. He got to Chicago in 4.5 hours, which was crazy.
Yeah.
But you know, the doctors had come in and they were like, look, the ORs are quiet right now and you've had a very stressful pregnancy. Let's just go ahead and take him and we'll be back. And so I'm Skype chatting with Jonathan and I'm like, you know, telling him, you've made me the happiest woman in the world. Please take care of these children. I'm giving him this loving message that I know that he's going to keep coming back to. And he's still not getting it. And he's like, you know, where do I meet you? And I said, 8th floor recovery, hopefully. And shut that down, hugged my daughter, Adina. And, you know, as soon as they gurneyed me down the hall, I broke down crying because I was sure it was the last time I was going to see her. And as I'm being wheeled into the OR, I tell my doctor, there is something wrong. You need to put me under general anesthesia. And she's like, Stephanie, I know you're nervous. Jonathan's not here. I will be your husband and your quarterback. but if I put you to sleep, then I put the baby to sleep. And so trust me, right? So I get wheeled in to the room. And CT, I don't know if you felt this way prior to your transplant, but it was, you can feel your heartbeat and your breath and everything getting louder and in your ears, and it gets quiet. And there's noise happening around you, but all of a sudden it's more of like, you know, for me, I'm being wheeled into the room, very conscious that I'm going to give life to my son. And this is the same room that's going to take mine.
Man.
And wow. I get, well, you know, go ahead.
I wanted to tell your husband, because my wife was there for two of my flat lines. She was there for two, and it was not a darn thing she could do. So even if he was there, it wasn't a darn thing he could do. So tell him not to feel too bad.
Yeah, but I saw your interview about your son when you couldn't do the push-up.
Yeah.
Help. And, you know, as a man, he's like, he's there to protect. Even if he can't do anything, his mere presence, I'm sure your family knows, your mere presence just being there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not seeing you on the ground, but seeing you there is enough to make everybody feel protected and stable.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And so I think from, so when a woman is having a C-section, they put a curtain in front of your face, your arms are like in a T, it is very sterile, it's cold. And given the fact that I am counting down the minutes before I die, they told me from the time from what I remember to the time I flatlined was about 15 minutes. I don't remember any of it. I feel like I scared myself out of my body or compartmentalized somehow. And then was like, I need to not see what's this train about to hit me. So they deliver Jacob happy and healthy. And seconds later, I'm dead. And what I ended up having was a very rare pregnancy complication, a 1 in 40,000 risk called an amniotic fluid embolism. It's the first part of an amniotic fluid embolism is you go into cardiac arrest. And the second part, if you're lucky enough to survive, which 40% do, you go into DIC, which is your body's inability to clot blood. So you bleed out. And what is pretty extraordinary, there were two things that were extraordinary. First was they had a crash cart right there, and they resuscitated me within 37 seconds, but they also had extra blood. And when you get a typical C-section, you have 6 units of blood, but for some reason they had enough defrosted of O negative because I can only receive O negative. And later I found out that one of my last consultation was with anesthesia. And Dr. Grace Lim, Grace is incredible. Mm-hmm. And she said after she had the conversation with me and I went through all of my story and all of my premonitions, she hung up after telling me, they're teaching hospital, they prepare emergency drills. She said she'll never forget the last thing I said to her, which was, it is what it is, because that was the last person that I could talk to. She said, she had never had a patient speak so clearly about what was going to happen, had a baby before, had a C-section before, and sought out specialists to save her life. And with that one phone call, she flagged my file and incorporated the extra blood in the crash cart in the operating room. Yeah. But what was also, like in Spanish, they call it diocidencias, like God's coincidence. 3 weeks prior to, now no one at Northwestern Memorial Hospital on my case had ever seen an AFE. It's so rare. So Northwestern delivers 12,000 babies a year. At the time they'd been in existence 30 years, they'd only had 10 full-blown AFEs like mine. 6 did not make it and the other 3 were in permanent vegetative states. So when you think about that, what I tell you next is pretty extraordinary because I found out later that 3 weeks prior to my AFE, the 2 anesthesiologists that were on my case, Grace, who wasn't scheduled to be there, but was there, and Dr. Nicole Higgins went to their annual association for American anesthesiologists, and they didn't go into a featured speaker. It was an abstract about how to resuscitate an AFE patient using a new method. And once they determined it was an AFE, 3 weeks later, they used that method and I was back up. And it's pretty crazy. So all this happens. Jacob is healthy, fine. He's he's in the nursery. Jonathan arrives and he's like, how's Steph? How's Jacob? And they're like, Jacob's fine. Stephanie's stable. And he's smart enough to know that's not good. And so the anesthesiologist, and they tell you that anesthesiologists and air and pilots think very similarly. So they were very grateful they had somebody that wasn't overly emotional. He was very much focused on, what do we need to do to get to the next phase, next phase, next phase. And by the way, if she needs a hysterectomy, this is the doctor we met with 2 months before. And she said, we've stabilized the bleed. I don't think she'll need it, but why would you meet with a gynonc, And she's like, well, they took down the name. And then 7 hours later, I was still hemorrhaging and they called in the gynonc to come in and perform the hysterectomy. The same scar that I had been envisioning for months. And then when they did the pathology on the uterus, they showed that an accreta had started to form, but the MRI didn't pick it up at the time. So I'm in a medically induced coma. My kidneys failed. I am completely edemic. I went in weighing 175 pounds. I was now like 220. It was like, I was severely, I had so much fluid. So at around the 7th day, 6th day, they extubate you just to see if there's any neurological deficit, and see where I am. And as soon as they extubated me and brought me back up, the very first thing I said, looking down at my swollen belly, is like, am I still fucking pregnant? And my husband was like, I think she's going to be okay. So, like where I was. But
she's
but I was floored that like 6 days had passed. And I don't know about you, but I was obsessed with like, what did you eat during that time? Like, what were people, you know, what were you doing? What happened? You know, and I couldn't grapple the fact that I lost 6 days, just complete block, like days and days and days. And then spent the next month in the hospital. And I can totally relate to you when you said, you know, after understanding that you had a woman's heart and the statistics, and you knew that you're blessed, but you know, it's what you're going to make of it. So how are you going to get stronger? Like there is no choice. The one things the doctor said is like with my kidneys, they said the only way she's getting out of the hospital is if she's having a little fluid, like if she can actually go to the bathroom on her own. Even if I couldn't express a lot, at least then I would do outpatient dialysis. But I had to be able to walk and move steps. So I don't know what happened, but all I know is that I have ports in my chest, in my, you know, neck and everything, and no one's paying attention to me. But I'm like, I'm going to walk. So I took for granted that the bottom of my feet were like balls because I was edemic. And so I stood up and then I went down and hit my head and everything. And everybody was like, what are you thinking? I'm like, I need to get out. I need to get back to life. I need to, you know, move. I needed, you know, and so.
I don't know if you saw the video of this one trying to run through the parking lot.
Yeah, because he
thought he could run after having a heart transplant and face planted right there in the parking lot.
Yeah, well, you're talking about it. That's what I thought. Immediately thought about the parking lot.
Yeah, but I mean, the reality is, I never lifted weights until I was 49. So it was like 8 years after the birth. I was tired of complaining about all the scars and the body and everything. And you know, everybody was like, Stephanie, you're lucky to be alive. Like it's okay. And I'm like, yeah, but it could be better. And the doctors were like, well, you could do a mommy makeover. I'm like, I am not going under a knife electively. I'm like, you guys are crazy. And so once I started dealing with all the PTSD, I found that women's bikini competitions were like the fastest way to get into shape, stupidly, because I was like, all right, I had no idea what that looked like. And thank God I didn't have any idea what it looked like. But when I was done and I competed and I got on stage, from the NPC Illinois, what was it, the Gladiator. I took top five and second in my category. And I was like, and nobody saw the scar. That was what was empowering. It was like, I could see the scar and I could feel the trauma. And I could be like, wait, I get up and talk about spirituality and talk about a life after death and talk about intuition, medical narratives. And you want me in a glittery bikini and stripper heels? I'm like, this doesn't work for me. But they're like, you know, my trainer was just like, she was like, you have to get up there. The idea doesn't make a difference whether you place at all. The fact that you actually standing on your own 2 feet and walking on that stage was such a gift for me. But it showed the determination, the drive, the will, and what, you know, what the human brain and heart and body are able to do.
You looked absolutely amazing. As I was researching you, I saw the competition photos and you, I was just like totally blown away. You did an amazing job and you looked great. So congratulations to you on that.
Thank you. I was training with one of my coaches here in Florida, Kevin Spurlock. And when your podcast came up, he was like, You need to send in a message to CT. Like, he's amazing. I worked out at his gym in California. I'm like, I'm one of the originals. And I'm like, okay.
All right.
Okay, I'm doing it.
So let me ask you. So during those 37 seconds you flatlined, you said you had a spiritual experience. Can you describe what you saw, felt, and how it influenced your perspective on life and death afterwards?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, they talk about how a lot of people who've had near-death experiences don't remember them, right? They say maybe 10% of the cases out there remember. So people think that when they flatline or they have a near-death or what have you, that they didn't have it. What was interesting was I didn't remember anything. And like we talked earlier, you know, as a producer, I was getting asked like to do shows and I was on the Steve Harvey show. And Steve asked, you know, if I saw the light. And I said, I don't know, man, they gave me a lot of drugs, you know. So it was one of those moments where I said, you know what, I actually do want to understand if there is a way to find out what happened, then I want to, it would be stupid for me to say that we've got one life to live, or there's something beyond if there's a way to prove it or disprove it. I wasn't afraid of either or. I was just like, I needed answers, and traditional therapy was not helping me. And so I ended up going to a regression therapist, and regression therapy uses hypnotherapy to take you back into moments of trauma. So, you know, basically you go in as this already happened to you, and these memories are like film strips locked away in the brain. And then under hypnosis, you can access those film strips. Mm-hmm. And so I went back specifically to find out what happened during the 3 months I was having the premonitions, and then also the 37 seconds and the subsequent coma, because I was like, maybe I missed something because I was so panicked with everything else. And so I recorded all of my sessions. I videotaped them. I'd never been hypnotized before. If you can't tell, I'm slightly type A. So I was like, I don't want anyone telling me, controlling my mind. And also, I didn't know if I'd remember anything. There was definitely a neurological deficit, and I had memory issues. Still do, but now it's more menopause than anything.
So, you sound like my wife.
Right? Like your wife is going to be like, I love her. I'm like, I can't wait to talk more about So we finally got into the OR after many, many hours of therapy. And at one point, you know, Stephanie, so I'm split into three. So I'm Stephanie, the observer, coming in and watching the screenplay, right? There's Stephanie on the gurney, which is getting ready to deliver. And then I see a translucent Stephanie perpendicular to my body. So I feel the heartbeat on the EKG. I can hear it beep, beep, and it's getting louder in my ear. But then all of a sudden, I see my grandmother who passed, who I was very, very close to, standing next to on the other side of me. The anesthesiologist, Grace, was standing next to the EKG monitor, and my spirit was standing next to Grace. And at the moment of flatline, my spirit shoots up. So you see everything almost like in a monochromatic, like not sepia, but like, you know, some sort of greenish haze or whatever. And then the spirit shoots up. So I say, you know, technically I did not see a light, but I don't know if I were the eyes of spirit, then maybe I would have. But so that happens. Then all of a sudden, it's like the whole hospital opens up where you see everything. You see up floors and around. I saw the labor and delivery room. I saw the lunch break room. I saw what my daughter was doing with our nanny in the room. I saw that my anesthesiologist was by my feet. I saw who hit the button for the code. I saw that my doctor, I kept hearing her saying, this can't be happening, this can't be happening. And I saw her freeze. I saw that the first crash cart didn't work, but the second crash cart did. Like there were lots of things that I saw. And then I saw spirits, and I saw hundreds of spirits. And it was like I was and I don't know, like if you love the beach, then maybe that's your perfect scenario. But I was like, it was a warm, I mean, like I felt sand under my feet, and I felt it was warm. You love mountains and skiing, maybe your heavenly experience is more like that. But I was two steps down from all of these spirits. Mm-hmm. And so I saw my uncle, And my uncle, who I was extremely close to, my mother's brother, Uncle Marvin, you know, he kept saying, you've known this all the time. You need to go back. You need to fight, you know. And the one thing, you know, I wrote in the book was that I kept craving cigarettes and I've never smoked before and I'm asthmatic. So the only thing when a man would be smoking or a woman in the streets of New York, when I was walking around, I'd be like, I'd walk closer to the cigarettes. And my uncle was the only person who had the balls to smoke in front of me because everybody else was worried about my health. He was like, fuck it. You know? So, so he was there, you know, I just felt like all of a sudden that made sense. And then I saw my other grandmother. I saw lots of people. Then I saw people I did not know. And on a television interview, I had this, you know, Megyn Kelly. She's like, you know, well, they, you know, Psychology Today talks about, of course, like, cause I know CT, you were like, okay, your mom was there. I said, okay, I'll give you Psychology Today says, of course, when you're having a near death experience, your loved ones show up because it's comforting. I said, all right, we'll put a pin in that. Let's pin in that one. What about the people I did not know who had messages for people I do know? And I am not a psychic medium. So I saw my best friend's little brother who passed when he was 7. And this was before I even knew her. And he had a message. And then I also met my husband's father. And my husband's father had this coin in his hand. It was a very specific coin. I was watching him twirl the coin and he was wearing a specific jacket, like a, you know, a tweed jacket. So all of this happens, right? And I come back and I'm like, I feel like there's like a weight lifted. I don't know about you, but I just felt like, okay, I have answers. And then of course my husband, God love him, and you can understand why he got hate mail. He said, how do you know this is not a recalled episode of Grey's Anatomy in your head?
Of course he did. Yeah, he's MC squared. Yeah, of course he had to say that.
As the strongest man in the world, I think you might not have said that to your wife at that time.
Of course he said that. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't logical. It wasn't logical. So.
At all.
Yeah,
at all.
Not logical at all. Yeah, I you know, like you said, I seen my mom and I absolutely knew that it was her without a shadow of a doubt, just like I'm sure you knew that that was your uncle, your grandmother. You knew absolutely without a shadow of a doubt. I could not see her face, but I knew absolutely it was her. Did you see their faces?
I did. When I see them now, I get a flash frame and I see jewelry. I get like a figure with jewelry, hair, what have you. I don't actually see all the eyes and everything made out, but there's a glow to them, but I can tell what the relationship is to the person.
Absolutely.
Or it's an aunt or it's a brother. And I don't know how that works.
I don't either.
But it's, I'm like, oh my God, you just lost your best friend. And they're like, it's a complete stranger. And they're like, how do you know that? And I'm like, I don't know. All right. And I'm like, so I've learned to like, you know, pull it back a little bit. But so I said to my husband after I was done, you know, saying a few choice words, I said, okay, you're right. I said, I could conflate a TV show I worked on with something I watched with, you know, a memory or what have you. I said, so I called the therapist and I said, how do you know what I'm telling you is true? And she said, well, sometimes the only validation we get is the patient feels better and you feel better. I said, that's not good enough. I have witnesses. So I took the tapes with me and then I recorded the reaction to the doctors that were present. So remember I said, which, you know, nurse jumped on my chest, had this whole framing. And I also said to my husband, our doctor did not deliver the baby. And he said, what are you talking about? She was there. I said, no, she was there, but she did not deliver the baby. And he said, well, who delivered the baby? I said, the resident that was in the gynec meeting that was taking notes that rolled her eyes at me. And he's like, why would that happen? She was on gyne-onc rotation. Like he was, I said, I don't know. That's what I saw. He's like, okay, honey, whatever. You know, so I go back to the doctors, I videotape them, and they're like, this is accurate down to where we're standing, what we're doing. My anesthesiologist said, I didn't go to medical school for this. Like, you know, she's like, you know, you could hear, you know, maybe hearing is the last to go, but your eyes were taped shut after we resuscitated you. You know, there was no way you could watch everything with the curtain in front of your face prior to flatlining. You didn't know who was in the room. My doctor, who kept saying, this can't be happening, so loudly, she's like, I did say that, but I had a mask on and it was under my breath. And I was at your feet. And then this woman comes up to me and says, Miss Arnold, I'm so happy to see you out of a wheelchair. And you don't remember me. I said, and it hit me like a wave, just like this, knowing, I said, you broke my ribs. And she's like, and I do it again to save your life. Wow. And she went back to her office because she was in management at that point. Because you're talking, this was like 9 months later, 10 months later. And I was told later that she just bawled her eyes out because she's like, I should not know this. And then they had to check the file. It wasn't even in the file. They had to check with the anesthesiologist that there was a second crash cart that came in because they did not remember that because it was pretty hectic. And then the kicker was, I asked Julie in front of my husband, my doctor, I said, did you deliver Jacob? And she's like, no. I said, did Dr. Hyo Park, the resident gynec, deliver the baby? And she said, how do you know that? She's like, 15 minutes before your procedure, you know, we're in a teaching hospital. So we offer whoever's in the back hallways, who's actually, you know, up for fellowship or what have you. And so she wasn't even on my team. It was just coincidence. Yeah. Wow.
So can I ask, and you talked about your husband, did all of this, and I'm sure he wasn't trying to be insensitive, but it might have come off that way. Did it take a toll on your marriage? Was there ever any issues with that? Like, how did that affect the two of your relationship going through that process?
Because I know you're feeling it also, like how that would react. You
know, I've been around enough women to know when.
So just so you know, I did not know we had a real problem until the Netflix thing came out. Because when the Netflix thing came out, you know, I keep it moving. It's like, we're like, okay, let's move away from the trauma. Mm-hmm. I write a book. Let me talk. Let me pitch a TV show. Let me do whatever. And let me stay as far away from that pain as possible. And okay, Netflix wants to do something. Okay, great. So I wasn't paying attention. And I guess when the show came out a year later and I got so much mail about, you really should forgive your husband, I'm like, what are they seeing that I'm not seeing? And I could see, and I took a closer look at the body language and how much pain I was in over the fact that he didn't listen to me.
Yeah.
Because I didn't care whether the doctors listened to, as of course I care, but I didn't care as much as the most important person in my life was doubting the truth. And it took me 2 years. It took me a very long time to say, wait, he did work within the confines of what he knew how to protect me the best way he could. He went with me to his appointments. He asked questions. He ruled out everything, even though I was stressed. And in his mind, he's thinking maybe there's something wrong with the baby, but he's not put that out into the universe. He's just going to verify, validate, and everything. And so it definitely took a huge toll for years because, you know, here I am feeling like I wouldn't be here if I didn't speak up. And, you know, I at one point he's like, well, if you believe in, you know, your predetermination or free will, which is it? I said, I think they run on different paths. I think my expiration date is my expiration date. How well I survived was due to my free will.
Man.
Anything else before I go on?
Yeah. Okay.
But he has changed. I mean,
yeah. You know,
when I said I saw his father, this is the funny story and like annoying and funny, but so I saw his father, and after my therapy session, I said, oh, I met your dad. And he's like, I'll tell him I said hi. Right. So I'm like, okay, forget all of that for a second. I said, so he was wearing a tweed jacket that had these stripes on it, and there's patches on his elbow, and there was a little green lapel. And he's like, my dad doesn't own a tweed jacket, or never owned a tweed jacket. Okay, forget about the jacket. Talk to me about this coin. I said, because I feel like, and I don't know, CT, if you have visions or when you see these spirits, it's almost like you have to sleuth what they're saying to get the message clear. And so, so he had this coin, and I had all of these details to the coin. It was a foreign coin. It wasn't silver. It wasn't gold. It was like a, you know, this different odd shaped metallic. It had, I was describing the insignia around, and he kept like rolling the coin in his hand. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Right. So I go to every single family member, you know, and I go to the sister-in-law, and I said, you know, he was wearing a tweed jacket, but Jonathan said he didn't have a tweed jacket. And she's like, can you explain it to me? She's like, what is he talking about? That's his favorite jacket. He wore that all the time. And I go back to my husband and I said, what are you talking about? His favorite jacket. He's like, well, if you would have said herringbone.
Oh, wow. Be more specific. Please.
What the fuck is a herringbone? So he's like, it's the name of a stitch in a tweed jacket. So I was like, right. So, and then I finally get to the last brother who I hadn't talked to about this. And he's like, and I ask about a coin. And he's like, it's funny you should mention about a coin. He's like, I was going through one of dad's old suitcases, and in the crevice of the suitcase, there was a coin. And I said, can you describe that coin to me? And it was almost verbatim. Wow. I look at my husband and I said, wow. Fuck you. And then, so he knew something was going on. It turned out that this was brother, the son that was with his father the day he died in London, and it was a big snowstorm, and so there was nothing he could have done about, but he's lived his life, you know, having this pain of like what he could have done. The coin was from Croatia. Wow. And he wanted his son to remember those moments and not the other, and to let it go. Wow. And it came as clear as day once I knew who had the coin and everything. So given all of those elements, when Jonathan finally said it on Surviving Death, that he's like, you know, I'm aware that she must have this extra sense. And I believe her. I broke down crying because it was like, I had waited all the, it wasn't conscious, yeah. But I had waited all of this time to actually feel it from him, from a very, very very deep spiritual place.
Okay. So let me ask you, so before you started having the premonitions about you dying during childbirth, had you ever had premonitions before that? Or was that the first time you had those?
No, I had them as a kid, and, okay. But I talk about it as being on low voltage, meaning I'd feel death before it comes. Like, I don't know why. And healthy people like my grandmother that, you know, had a massive coronary when we were 3,000 miles away. And I felt it in my heart. And I told my father, have you checked on her? And he's like, no, but it's late. I'll call tomorrow. And that was the moment she had her fatal heart attack. It was like it shot in my body, felt it. It was her. And then my uncle, who I was very close to, the one that was there through my premonitions. Mm-hmm. I hugged him. He had, we saw each other for the holidays. And then he, when I hugged him, I felt this overwhelming, sad feeling. And I told my mother, cause my mother's brother, I said, I feel like I'm never going to see him again. And then the next day he had a massive coronary and died. And so, but he was healthy. He was like running 5 miles a day, and, you know, changed his eating habits. So it was just feeling it. And then you go asystolic, which is, well, first of all, then I have this foreboding. So I basically, when I was a kid, I just was like, I'm willing this to happen. I had no one to talk to about this. The people I did talk to about it said, you know, put bad feelings into the universe or thoughts into the universe and shut it down. So I just shut it down until it was my own foreboding. And then I was like, oh, I'm not stopping. Because people say, well, after the 10th doctor told you were crazy, I would stay quiet. I said, then you would have stayed dead. Wow. And it's not worth staying quiet if it's going to save. So I go asystolic, so no electricity running through my body. And then when you get plugged back in, you're on high voltage. Yeah. And so it took me easily 3 years to come out from hiding because I couldn't go to play dates or parties or anything because I'd start feeling everybody's stuff. And, you know, you become more empathic through a near-death experience and through trauma. I think, you know, trauma is what gives you that superpower of a heightened intuition. And that's the only gift, or well, there's several, but there's gifts that come from going through something that's really hard. And it was something that was in my blood. My grandmother was Santera, which, you know, she's Cuban. She, my father's mother, always believed in extrasensory perceptions. You know, when I was doing a book tour in Mexico, I spent a lot of time in the States talking about the premonitions and everything I documented, because the book was written really for someone like Jonathan, where it was like, okay, I need you to give me all of the evidence, you know, prior to this happening, to at least get me from atheist to agnostic, right? Yeah. So he's a hopeful agnostic, right? So you move into that direction. In Mexico, they automatically know what you're talking about because they've experienced it it's rooted in their faith and their culture. When you're in China, the same thing. And so it's interesting to see like how much I didn't have to go out of my way to prove, even though it's in my DNA to say, hey, look at all the evidence. And just giving more validation to people who've had near-death experiences who really don't know if they actually have had them.
Did this experience, this 37 seconds, totally erase any fear of death?
Yes.
Absolutely. I say that a lot. You know, after you've come that close to it, you're not afraid of it anymore.
Yeah, because the actual moment of impact isn't painful. There's a sadness that you're not going to physically be with the people you love.
Yes.
You know, and there's I think the terrifying part for me was having 3 months to plan, you know, like, this is going to happen. No one believed me. And I, you know, when they tell you, if you're given an expiration date and you're like, oh, spend as much quality time with your family. Well, I screwed that up because all I was doing was racing as fast as I can to try and save my life. So I was like, okay, I'll get back to playing cards with you later, but I need to
I got to do this.
But I know that love transcends life. I know that life transcends life. I know that, you know, the things that you feel with others around is like, okay, so we transition from a solid to another form. I used to say I would transition from a solid to a gas. And I was like, I don't want to be a gas. I'm like, it's a metaphor. But yeah, I mean, there's a reason, like, if I didn't feel it, like, you didn't feel your loved ones, it's like, how could you feel it just because you smelled their perfume because somebody sprayed their perfume? No, you smelled their perfume because no one sprayed their perfume often.
Is there any doubt in your mind whatsoever that death is not the end?
Is there doubt that
any death doubt? Is there any doubt that death is not the end? None.
It's not the end.
None.
I think that's why any of us that have these kind of experiences, it's like, okay, when it's my time. I'm not, you know, the poor guy that survived the Twin Towers only to die on a ferry boat. I mean, it was time. Yeah. It's like, just put me to rest. Right. It's like, and what I was fascinated by was Mike Tyson's answer the other day. Did you hear him when he was interviewed by that 12-year-old girl?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I felt sorry for the little girl.
That's interesting. I never heard that. Of course you never have. But I thought that was very astute of him in his, where he is in his life, to say, no one's going to give a fuck. Does it look like? Like, it's really coming from an egotistical place. And I, you know, I can appreciate what he's saying.
Absolutely, yeah.
to the people that love you the most, that you see every day, that you have impacted their life, they're the ones that, you know, you feel bad for because you want them to whole again. But if I or you or any of us can give the assurance to people that haven't had those experiences and are uncertain about it and have less faith in what's happening, then that's part of our mission in life.
Absolutely. I'm on the Joe Rogan show and talking about this, and I'm telling Joe that I'm absolutely certain, there's no doubt whatsoever, that that death is not the end, that there's life after this. And Joe goes, well, how do you know? And I said, because I've been dead, Joe.
And so what does he say?
He goes, yeah, he still didn't want to buy it, but I'm telling you from experience, man. There's something after this, buddy. Trust me.
And that's the thing. There's so many people that downplay and say, well, these near-death experiences are hallucinations or they're whatever. And I'm like, but there's hundreds of thousands of them. And if you are a PhD in any capacity, data is data.
Absolutely.
And so why does that data get discounted because it's supernatural versus other data that you're counting? And, you know, your brain is your brain. You'll have an individual thumbprint, but these experiences sound similar for a reason.
Yeah. And, you know, Joe's sounds a lot like your husband, very educated, analytical, and he wants to, you know, he wants everything to fit in a certain box and it's got to add up. Yeah, I'm like, hey, I don't give a damn if it adds up, Joe. I'm telling you from experience, man.
I know, I love that. I enjoy the pushback. I remember I was at a medical school and I was lecturing about our case, and the faculty advisor said, you know, Stephanie, I am aware of your case. He said, but I'm not going to flag every histrionic neurotic patient and put blood and whatever in there. And there were a lot of residents in the lecture. And I said, you know, I said, just like I said to you, I said, you're missing one key important factor, which is my doctors knew me as their patient and were taking it for granted that this was just going to be just an everyday kind of thing. And this was atypical behavior. And that's why I'm talking about going back to narrative medicine, like actually get to know what's happening in the patient, like just listen to them, because it would have calmed me a lot just hearing, like, you know. And so after that lecture, maybe four or five different residents came up to me and said, you know, I had a mother like you, you know, that was very intuitive. And so they are not supposed to talk about these things. Grace will tell me, look, I am very spiritual. I thank God every patient that I walk into their room, because there's a reason that I'm put in their path. It's not something I learned in medical school, but it's something that I take to heart and soul. And so, you know, I will, to my dying breath again, say that we are here maybe to validate others, these experiences that you have. I mean, for you to rebuild yourself after going through what you went through, and somebody saying they're too tired to go to the gym, you're not going to hear that. I cannot tell you how many mothers have told me, well, you know, I can't lose this fat and I can't do this. And I'm like, you are barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, you're telling the wrong person.
I am blown away about just the similarities between the two of you. And like some of the stuff that you say is stuff I hear him say all the time when it comes to this experience. So there was clearly a reason the two of you need to be connecting. Like I said, he very rarely ever says, son, I need this person on the show.
I love that.
Very rarely does that ever happen. But for the two of you to come together and to hear these stories, it's like, you know, and it made me think about my own experience. I had an aorta dissection about 4 years ago. And I remember the doctors told me, they were just like, it's a possibility you may not go home. Now, I didn't legally die or anything of that nature, but I remember sitting there thinking, what the hell have I done with my life? If this the end, like everything, when they say like your life flashes before your eyes, like everything that I had did and everything that I had said I wanted to do and didn't do, all of that stuff just started flashing before my eyes. And when you come out of something like that, even though I'm healthy. There's eventually I'll probably have to have a stent put in somewhere down the line, but right now I'm good. But coming out of that, it really made me look at life totally different and just like really what's important. And what's important is your family, your friends, being good to people. That's what I took out of that whole experience. And, you know, I sit here and I tell this story all the time, and people are probably tired of hearing me say it, but being around this man, watching him when he's sick, and just we go to these conventions and he's shaking everybody's hand. He's standing up. He's not sitting down. And to there were times where I'm just like, he's going to fall out. But he was just like, son, it's my job. You know, if these people have come all the way, some people come from clear across the world. Yeah. You know, it's people from Europe, people from the Middle East. And he was like, if these people came all this way to see me, at least I could do a stand up and shake the hand. And that's what's important. It's just being good to people, giving them good experiences. And I'm just, I don't know. It's weird to, I'm not going to say weird. It's just, it's interesting to sit here and listen to the two of you who have technically been dead and just how it changed your perspective on life coming out of that. So, and one of the last questions, we're already over an hour, but I got to ask you. So with the climate of the world today, there's a lot of women worried about their maternal health and all of that stuff with everything going wrong and not going into politics and anything of that nature. But since your experience, you've become an advocate for patient rights and maternal health. What inspired you to take on that role, and what changes do you hope to see in the medical field going forward?
You know, I want patients to take more responsibility of their own narrative. So they need to really come into an appointment, right or wrong. I think it's wrong, but that if a patient sounds educated enough about their own experience and wants to be involved, they can push back with a doc that might be pushing you down a path that you just don't feel is right for you. I think too many times patients and doctors alike think, okay, one from the patient side, okay, if they don't say anything, I'm out. But, you know, I might have I might be nervous about something, but I'd rather not discuss it. If the doctor finds it, I'll deal with it, but I'm dodging a bullet. And then from the doctor's perspective, they're having so many patients come in that they don't spend time with them. The key thing is talking to them, talking to the family members. You know, it's like actually getting to know the patient, because you'll find out more from those moments and what the real fears are, or what a patient is telling you. I can't tell you how many stories I hear about women and men, but more women than men. Like, I felt the lump. I was dismissed because I was 23 years old. And then it turned out to be breast cancer. With Black women, the same thing. I was dismissed because of my color. They just assumed that I was, you know, just stupid or whatever it was that they were assuming. And they just dismissed me. And the racial bias absolutely exists in medicine. And there is a saying that a lot of clinicians and the nurses are the ones that are really the ones that are better connected with the patient and helping the patient stand again and, you know, relaying information and being your best advocate. And there is something that, you know, and right now my menopausal brain is not doing it. However, there is something about how that patients were getting dismissed. Well, being dismissive of those patients can lead to fatalities. Yeah. And in my case, dismissing me, not because of the color of my skin, but dismissing me because my voice didn't need to be heard, caused something as well. So I would like to just say both on both sides need to be more responsible. And by the way, I don't know if you guys already know this, but I did not know that the anesthesiologist is the one who's in charge of keeping you alive.
Yeah. I know.
I know. Yeah. And I too. But you have every right to have a consultation with that anesthesiologist before you put that stent in. Mm-hmm. You have a consultation with anesthesia and you say, I am afraid of this and that. I will tell you that anesthesiologists, when you say to them, I feel like I'm going to die, everything stops. Because they know more times than not that when a patient says that, the patient, that foreboding, which exists prior to an embolus and prior to a heart attack, that the patient is feeling it way before the staff is seeing it.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. So, and a lot of people who follow me know I've lost like 270 pounds over the course of the last 6 years. So some years ago, I had to have skin removal surgery from my midsection. They gave me too much anesthesia. I was put under. They could not wake me up for like a day. Only thing I remember being on the table, going to sleep. And when I woke up, I was in the hospital in the emergency room, like literally a day later. And the only thing I just remember going to sleep and waking up and not knowing what happened. Come to find out, they was like, oh, we gave you too much anesthesia, and freaked my wife out. Everybody was just going crazy. So now I have this weird thing. I haven't had to be put under since then, but I know if there's ever a time, it's probably going to trigger something. And like I said, and it was weird because I've been put under multiple times before that, but just this particular incident. And he said, we kind of gauged you, because at that time I had lost about 150 pounds by then. So, but I still look kind of, you know, I still had some size on me. So they just assumed that, okay, well, you're a big guy. We got to give you more anesthesia. Right. They just mapped it out wrong. And I just remember my wife going ballistic. Like, she was ready to turn that hospital upside down because she was like, you could have killed him. Like, you know, you literally could. And it was funny because I had a Facebook memory that popped up, and she had took a picture of me, and I saw it, but I never really paid attention to it till the other day when it popped up, and it was me in a hospital bed. They got the mask on my face, the breathing tubes everywhere. And I just remember sitting there looking at them like, wow, like, you know, just how lucky I was to be able to come through that. Yeah, so the stuff about the anesthesia analog just really just clicked something in me and just took me back to that moment. So definitely speaking up for yourself, and whether you're a man or a woman, you're right. The doctors really need to take time to listen to the patient and understand where they're coming from and not just say, well, you know, I've been to medical school, I know more than you, and totally blow the person off.
Yeah, I had one doctor that said to me when I went back to thank everybody for saving my life, I said, you know, they were all like, every one of them was like, I don't have a medical explanation for you. You need to go spiritual on this one. Yeah. Except for one, the gynoc, he was like, self-fulfilling prophecy. And I was like, are you serious? And I said, you think that I can manifest my organs combining hemorrhage, hysterectomy? He's like, why didn't, no, I don't think that, but it's the only thing I can come up with. And I'm like, well, it's an asshole thing to say. Because of course, psychologically, you think that you are manifesting death, or you're manifesting 10 stitches in your head, and you're like, oh, I can just think away the problem. No, how about I can feel it happening? And some people are more intuitive than others, or are tied in.
Yeah. All right, Stephanie. I tell all of our guests, we do these hours and they just fly by and I don't get to half the questions that I had. But I just want to say, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Your story is absolutely amazing. I'm so glad that you're still here. You have a new fan in me. You already had a big one in Mr. Fletcher over here. We just want to thank you. Thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. You know, when we started this show, we tell people all the time, we named it the F Y'all Podcast. We were worried that it was going to turn people away, but we are glad that you can look past the derogatory name of this show and come on and tell your story to our listeners, who I'm sure will appreciate the story just as much as we have. So we want to personally thank you again. And let me apologize to you too for the time mix up. Thought I told you that it was 3 o'clock Pacific time we booked this, so clearly we had a mix up on that one. So I totally apologize, because I can tell it's extremely late there where you are right now. So thank you for staying up with us and coming on the podcast. Pops, you got anything before we get out of here?
Stephanie, I am so proud of what you're doing. I cannot thank you enough for being on here. You're an amazing woman. Tell your hubby that I don't blame him so much. He's still all right with me. But, you know, you're just amazing. Keep doing what you're doing, because your testimony or your story is going to save many, many people.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's give our thanks to Miss Stephanie Arnold for coming on the F Y'all Podcast. We appreciate you so much. Thank you,
Stephanie.
Thank you.
Stay tight. We're going to end this show like we end every show. You want to kick it off, Pops?
As we always say, fuck y'all.